You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. In these podcasts, we explore a huge range of crucial issues and exciting developments in the food industry with brilliant guests drawn from all areas of expertise. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a TV presenter and writer, and I specialize in food and science. Today's podcast is one of our Future Gazing Trends series, and this one focuses on retail trends that we think might take center stage in 2021. Now, so you need to put yourself on the line here and do a bit of future gazing, because sometimes it's a fool's game, but I want to explore how consumer demand is shifting due to factors including COVID-19, and you may not want to talk about that anymore, but it's important to us. How will the food and drink landscape change in 2021, and what are the key trends driving the change? Now, the twist is that a year ago, we were predicting greater demand for food on the go, but almost the opposite has happened. Lockdown has elicited new approaches to cooking, home breakfast boom, and an increase in scratch cooking. Consumer concerns in health and well-being continue to grow, but a third of those who took part in the COVID symptom study app gained weight between March and July. So what's going on, and can we predict anything for 2021? Well, to joining this to discuss it are Mark Driscoll, Director at Tasting the Future.
Hello there.
Laura Swain, editor, food and beverage and travel and hospitality at Stylus.
Hi.
And Simon Waring, managing director and owner, Greenseed UK Limited.
Hi.
So first of all then, Mark, did you put on weight during lockdown or did you lose weight?
I think I put on a pound and a half. So
Not bad,
but I did do a lot of exercise too, but I think it just points to eating too much food at home for some reason.
And doing nothing. Okay. So what do you think will be the biggest factor in trying to work out what food and drink trends are going to be for 21 when it comes to consumers?
Obviously, I think there'll be continuing rising concerns over the impact of our food choices, obviously, on our health. We've touched on sustainability and animal welfare. I actually think health, provenance, immune resilience, obviously animal welfare, sustainability concerns will actually prove to be kind of key selling points. And I think, obviously, we can't talk about trends without talking about COVID.
Go on.
I do think, you know, history tells us that these so-called, many people would say COVID was a black swan event. And history tells us that many of these unexpected events can actually accelerate the pace of change we experience. And I think this trend, particularly in terms of food retail, certain trends are going to accelerate in terms of the pace of change. I'm sure we'll touch on some of these: plant-based eating, localization. And so COVID will significantly reshape and accelerate, or sometimes decelerate, some of those trends.
Okay, Laura. Now, COVID-19, it's a once in a century type concept, but people have been talking about resilience in the food industry and the supply chain for a long time. Should we have been better prepared? And do you think that this will change what our focus is in the years to come?
I mean, fingers crossed this is a once in a century occurrence. I mean, none of us can handle this all over again. I think it highlighted, in a way, the food system really did need this kind of a shake-up, because and it highlighted so many issues that I think we were all kind of ignoring, and like not enough effort was being put into kind of counteract these issues.
And is that mainly supply chain issues, do you think, and resilience, or does it go beyond that?
I think it goes beyond that. I also think it made consumers realise that they weren't prepared enough for this kind of thing either. I think going forward in the home, people are going to be much more prepared and have, you know, their pantries supplied, and that kind of goes all the way down the chain. I think.
Okay, now Simon, what about you? What do you think is? I mean, we all know that COVID's had a big effect. Is this going to be? We've just heard about the possibility of a vaccine coming in the new year. Can anyone make any predictions now on trends for 2021?
Well, it'd be very easy to end the podcast here and now and just say, no, we must be crazy to do that. So we're talking about you know, food on the go, for example, you know, people were making predictions that it was going to grow. I think in February, the same research organization, Illumina, predicted it was going to grow 2.7%, and now predicting it will go down 29% this year, but it'll surge back up again 40% in 2021. Now, you know, where that 40% figure comes from, I don't know. I think it's very hard to make predictions, but I think some of the trends and the changes that have taken place are definitely here to stay. So I think we can, I think we can be fairly sure that online shopping is going to continue, because even when we have more freedom to shop and leisure to shop in a variety of different locations, I think the convenience aspect of online is something that's going to be difficult to shake off for people. So, you know, I think in terms of supply chain resilience, obviously the bigger retailers have had to react phenomenally fast. And in fact, they did react very fast, really, because if you think a supermarket chain like Sainsbury's had something like 7% of their sales online, it took them about 25 years to get there. And then 8 weeks later, 15 to 16% of their sales were online. So I think the supply chains actually coped pretty well with things. Certainly online capacity is increasing massively now. And that and many other trends, I think, will be here to stay in the future.
And do you think that that investment into companies will focus on trends that can cope with big changes like COVID-19, whether or not there will be another or not? But are they likely to be the jewels in the investment crown if they are more resilient now?
I think so. I think if you're a food business as well, you had to think very, very fast about different routes to market. So a lot of smaller brands became very proficient at selling direct to consumer from their own websites or using other platforms like Amazon. And the bigger brands were slightly slower to react, in fact, but then began to do so as well. I think one of the great shames about the pandemic is that it actually stopped a lot of challenger brands in their tracks, because the bigger retailers who'd started to have some faith in them and give them some listings, you know, focused on the bigger brands to ensure there was regular supply. I think it's a way back for some of those brands, but those that have diversified and pivoted into different sectors and so on are likely to be the ones to survive and also be quite attractive to buyers, because we've noticed a surge in acquisition activity lately.
Yeah. So, Mark, have you seen that same concept, a sort of retreat from innovation and smaller challenger brands into the relative safety of the big players?
And it's been, I think, COVID has been quite a challenge with some of the innovator brands, but I'm sure they'll bounce back. And I think you know, out of a crisis comes opportunities. And I think the opportunities will be really significant. And I think the question of resiliency has really been in focus as a result of COVID. I think it will be even more in focus as we move into, we haven't mentioned the Brexit word, but I need to mention that as well, because I think that obviously is creating additional uncertainty on top of the pandemic. And I think it does pose, you know, some significant questions for the UK food economy in terms of particularly, I think, getting fresh produce to market when the UK is reliant on, I think, about 77% of the fresh produce, for example, that we consume in the UK comes from overseas. Can we continue to rely on overseas market? There's a lot of moves. I think, you know, one of the trends I've spotted from a consumer point of view is this whole kind of localization agenda. As we all work from home, work within our communities, it's boosted local retail outlets, but it's also boosted opportunities for local suppliers, particularly in things like fresh produce. So I think, you know, this issue of food security, how much of our food we grow, particularly in healthy and nutritious foods, where we've underinvested, you know, to be honest, you know, it's crazy to be importing apples from New Zealand when we could perfectly grow apples in the UK. I live in Herefordshire. We've underinvested in our orchards, temperate fresh fruit and vegetable production. And I think some of the key decision makers have got some real questions to be answered with some of those issues.
Yeah. And Laura, when it comes to the trends that consumers find most important, I mean, health and well-being has been, it's been on the table for quite a while now for a lot of consumers. What are they looking for? And will this change in the next year, do you think?
I know you mentioned at the beginning about people putting on weight during the start of the pandemic. We saw lots of indiscriminate snacking, and people were kind of turning to fatty and sugary foods for comfort. And kind of salty store-covered foods kind of gain new relevance. But I think next year, especially actually towards the end of this year and going into next year, consumers have begun to take a much more proactive approach to their health and well-being via their diet. They've obviously noticed that they want their bodies to be in kind of the best condition possible to fight off viruses and infections. And then they want to boost their kind of own immunity by taking a holistic view of their diets. I also think they are keen to tackle other health concerns that have been exacerbated by the pandemic, such as like mental health, lack of sleep, anxiety and stress and that kind of thing. And looking to their diet to kind of tackle this. And consumers intend to stick to these kind of healthy habits that have been accelerated this year. So 72% of UK shoppers say they plan to make permanent changes to their diet after the pandemic and kind of double down on this new kind of healthier outlook.
And how much can we trust them on that?
you make a good point. I mean, I guess consumers can only, you know, do their best at this point. I'm probably in this group of saying, you know, I'm really keen to, I really want to be healthier next year, but you know, I'm going to root in the fridge for a slice of cheese for a snack, for example.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's a January syndrome, isn't it? Yeah. but what else can we see in this sort of area in terms of consumer decision making? What about sort of functional foods and supplements, Laura?
Yes, absolutely. From a supplement standpoint, I saw an amazing stat the other day that said the global vitamin and mineral supplement market is expected to grow by $61 billion by the end of this year, which is a growth rate of 18.3%. So the numbers are huge here, indicating that consumers are kind of leaning into supplements for their health and well-being. And this is set to continue into next year, with consumers looking to supplements to address kind of a whole variety of health concerns, from like insomnia to kind of the much lauded kind of immunity boost. And these supplements need to be convenient and easy to take. So thinking about leaving the traditional pill format for things like gummies and coffee pods and that kind of thing, that offer kind of targeted and personalized health concerns. And from a functional food perspective, I think many will be kind of looking for the kind of line between supplements and food to become even more blurred than they already are. So functional foods will definitely continue their momentum into 2021. And they'll be looking to products that feature ingredients that have really kind of airtight, proven health benefits and kind of that fit into their busy lifestyles.
Yeah. Okay. And Simon, are there any, I mean, we've been talking about a lot of these concepts for quite a while now. So health and well-being and move to a plant-based diet as well. Are there any surprising changes that you're beginning to see coming through in terms of consumer trends?
Well, I suppose one in the drinks arena is this emergence just now of hard seltzers and, you know, these, you know, alcohol driven, you know, soft drinks, which is something which seems to be, you know, very much counter the trend. So, you know, in the US now, we know that things like, you know, hard kombucha are beginning to take off. Now, if you said that to a consumer, we've said that to most consumers today, to be honest, they wouldn't know what you're talking about, because most people still don't know what kombucha is. But the idea of hard Brexit may be a concept people are familiar with. Hard kombucha is something else altogether. And just shows how rapidly things can change. But they also take a while to settle down. And I think if you're very close to the food business and you're scanning the shelves of some of the more innovative retailers, you're aware of all these product launches. But they take time to hit the mainstream, and not all of them do in a big way.
Yeah. So do you think that is it simply the concept of novelty, or are we looking at some really exciting products that really might be game changing?
I think that's always possible. But I think if you think about the healthy snacking arena, for example, we've seen, you know, chickpea-based snacks, black-eyed pea snacks, quinoa, lentil, and so on. You know, all these products that have launched and done quite well at the margin, and an increasing number are marketing themselves now on the less than 100 calories proposition. But when you ask consumers whether these healthy snacks that they're seeing actually deliver on taste, only 20% of them agree. So that it's a big challenge, but also potentially a big opportunity for those who can get it right.
Yeah. Now we're talking about sort of, you know, alcohol related things. What about no alcohol? So the last year was a huge boom for no alcohol category. Do you think that's done a sort of gin industry burnout concept, or are we going to see more of that in the coming year?
I think we're probably going to see more of it. And one of the big signs of that is the, you know, the investment that some of the drinks giants are actually making in this area, either by launching their own low and no variants or by buying up some of the more successful startups like Seedlip, for example. So I think that's definitely a trend that's going to continue. And although people may have been drinking more over lockdown, they probably also been trying to balance their alcohol consumption with a bit of low and no alcohol consumption, and having the time and the thinking space, if you like, to start thinking about how they want to blend low and no into their normal alcohol driven diet.
Do you do that?
I've certainly started to do that. So I think if you have a gin and tonic two or three times a week, maybe one or two of those occasions might be a clean gin, for example, or you save the actual alcohol for the weekend. And if it's a spirits, you would always have a low and or no variant during the week. So I think people are happily balancing these things up a little bit and experimenting. And it's a gradual change in behavior.
Yeah. But do you think it is an example of a relatively fundamental change, or is it something that will come and then will go?
I think it's here to stay, but it's still, I mean, obviously the growth rates are very dramatic, but it's still a very tiny, tiny portion of the overall drinks market. So it's got some way to go before it becomes mainstream. But I think it's very likely to stay, as is, you know, the new pack formats, the smaller sizes, you know, the cans of wine that you can now buy, which are more likely going to be 330 mil rather than a bigger serving. Because, you know, to be honest, half bottles of wine are very hard to find, and not everyone wants to get through a bottle of wine over a day, 2 days, or even 3 days.
Although at the same time, we've just seen a kind of a focus from the beer industry towards pint-sized cans, and that there are some producers who are actually just going exclusively to pint-sized cans. Is that an example of the you know, demographics or the type of drinker that drinks beer as opposed to wine, do you think, or is it more complex than that?
I suppose it's about, you know, trying to segment your consumers and think, what does each group look for? And if there's a group out there who are looking for pints in cans, let's make sure we satisfy that need.
Yeah. Okay. Mark, have you spent most of lockdown hammered, or have you been mixing up a bit?
I've been mixing up a bit and a bit of a balance between my normal Peroni and a few of the kind of non-alcoholic alternatives. And gin is one of those I've actually tried, which was very nice, actually.
Excellent. Now, let's shift the focus a little bit onto things like plant-based foods. Now, we got climate change and sustainability issues at stake here. There's been a huge boom in sales. What do you think is next for the plant-based sector?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. And I think obviously COVID has increased awareness and the links between food, health, food security, sustainability. For the last obviously few years, plant-based foods have really skyrocketed in popularity. And all the signs are is that COVID has just accelerated the consumer demand from a health and sustainability perspective. And I think obviously growth forecasts, I've seen one recent figure where, you know, by 2024, forecast growth in meat alternatives is projected to increase to, I think, $480 billion quite significant. And actually, this presents significant opportunities for businesses investing in both plant-based and sustainable alternatives. And particularly, I think, as a result of COVID, the flexitarian market. So flexitarian, if you like, are those meat eaters that perhaps just want to reduce the amount of meat and look at plant-based alternatives. That presents probably some of the biggest opportunities. I think there are a number of trends here. I think it was Laura that mentioned the kind of trend around immuno-boosting food ingredients, both from a physical, mental health perspective. There are signs that citizens are increasingly making the link between gut and immune health. So potential increase in the purchase of probiotics, for example. I think, interestingly, we're going to see more clean label type plant-based protein products emerging over the next year or two. I think what I would call high protein leguminous foods are really going to take off. I don't know if anyone noticed in the media over the summer, a group of Norfolk farmers got together. We had our first crop of chickpeas, which I think were marketed to Hodmadons up in Norfolk, coming into the market. So we're going to see a lot more innovation in chickpeas, lentil, yellow split peas, for example. And I think, you know, just because it's a plant-based product, sometimes product developers, marketeers, brands think, you know, they can tick off the sustainability box, but actually, just because it's plant-based doesn't mean it's necessarily sustainable. So,
do you think we're seeing a sort of a second layer of interest? So, initially, you get the plant-based sort of celebration of fantastic. There's no meat involved here, but then you get, you know, now that it's becoming a little bit more mainstream, people are asking a little bit more of the category.
I think so, and I think probably that increasingly questioning some of those meat, you know, plant-based meat replacement burgers, for example, produced by the Beyond Meat or Impossible Food, particularly, I think, from a health perspective, because I think the sustainability benefits, you know, are clearer. But if you're still producing plant-based foods that are high in saturated fats, sugars, salts, I do question quite seriously some of the health benefits of these foods. So I think there will be increasing attention on some of those.
Yeah. Now, we're expecting that Joe Biden will re-sign up to the Paris Climate Agreement.
Right.
Do things like, do things like this, you know, the past 4 years where climate change in the US has been very much kicked around at the bottom of a barrel. Do things like this make any difference to how consumers consume foods?
Not necessarily immediately, but I do think the long-term signals feed into those changes because, you know, governments particularly, you know, have to show real leadership. And a lot of food businesses, to be fair, you know, big and small, have really shown kind of leadership on things like the plant-based front and the sustainability front. Much more needs to be done. But I think missing ingredient here is, you know, creating a level playing field for plant-based foods, for example. Mm. At the moment, governments heavily support and subsidize the livestock sector through agricultural subsidies, you know, a whole range of innovation and investment and signals from governments, you know, tap into consumer awareness and hopefully long-term a policy change. So really vitally important.
Yeah. Okay. Now, Laura, there's been a lot of innovation, especially around plant-based burgers. What's next, you know, as a target? You know, do you think that fish substitutes are likely in the near future? I mean, there are a few companies exploring these, but I don't think we've really sort of felt that it's made a difference yet.
I mean, absolutely. I think the in the fish space, like, there are kind of green shoots of kind of new interesting products. But I don't think, from my experience, I've tried a few, and I don't really think they've necessarily got the texture quite right yet. It's the same issues they were having with plant-based meat originally. I think it's definitely something that consumers would be interested in trying, but I don't think we're quite there yet.
Yeah. And any other types of innovation along those lines that you can see of? That's still a long way off from being really viable, but lab grown meat, and I guess also on the other side of things, you know, the insect as food sector.
I think with both of those sectors, actually, part of the issue I think they might have going forward is kind of more consumer acceptance of it. Because I think with insects, for example, they've been trying to make it happen for quite a long time, and we've been kind of tracking it. But I think packaging these things and marketing these things in a way that are appealing to consumers, it kind of hasn't broken over the barrier yet. And the same goes for lab-grown meat. I mean, I can't remember what the stat was, but I saw a stat the other day about, I think it was around about 75% of Gen Z consumers wouldn't try lab-grown meat. Mm. So, yeah, I think there's really an acceptance piece there that, you know, there's still some way to go.
Yeah. And what do you think about these other sectors, Simon, and potentially in any other areas that you think are not quite firing on all four cylinders yet?
Yeah, I think the big growth is going to be in clean label plant-based in general. I think seafood and fish, as other contributors have said, hasn't really taken off yet, hasn't really met the texture demands. I think the lab-grown meat, though, is a very interesting one. I definitely think there's some resistance at the moment, but we're some way off actually seeing this as potentially, you know, on people's plates. There are, you know, a large number of startups who are being, you know, very well invested in at the moment, who are growing in the US and Israel and other locations. So I definitely think that as we begin to sort of review the whole food production system and people take more of an interest, obviously that started with the whole plant-based movement, perhaps to some extent it'll grow in acceptance. I think on the insect side, I agree with Laura. I think, you know, I've seen those insect food companies at IFE and Specialty Fine Food and probably Food Matters too, in the last 5 or 6 years, and none of them have really taken off. They're great at raising media headlines, but we haven't yet seen any real breakthrough from a consumer point of view. So I think that's still some way off. I think the main concentration from a consumer point of view will be to have things that are as natural as and unprocessed as possible. That's got to be the thing for the future in plant-based.
Yeah, so I would agree with the insects. I think the real opportunity around insects is insects for feed, not necessarily insects for human consumption, because there's a whole bunch of cultural, you know, unless you've been brought up in the rural northeast of Thailand, for example, where insects have always been part of a traditional diet, we're really unlikely to change some of the consumer acceptability barriers. But insects to animal feed to replace dependence on soya for animal feed, you know, is the real opportunity space, in my view.
It's a really interesting concept, isn't it? So, Laura, I mean, if we look at novelty and people's fear of foods, I mean, the potato at one stage was you know, seen as ingredient for a witch's brew. It was seen as a sort of hateful, evil thing. And yet, because it had an economic imperative to it, it was cheap, it grew very well in temperate climates, you know, people got behind it. Do you think that you know, shifting something to a tipping point is not likely with some of these other ingredients because of the sheer diversity of markets now?
I think the potato example is interesting. I guess with insects, there's just this real ick factor that people have, that they are unlikely just to get over, to be honest. Mm. I think
Same with lab-grown meat as well. I mean, yeah. but it is the tipping point where, you know, if you do manage to get a lab-grown burger that tastes as good as a beef burger and is half the price, I would imagine a lot of people, that sort of 50% of people who say that they'd never taste it, I would imagine that they change their minds.
I mean, potentially. I mean, I guess if the price was right. But I also think, like, there'd have to be, like, a widespread kind of trialing process with people in different markets to see, and clever marketing at the end of the day.
Okay. Now, Simon, what other trends can we expect as part of environmental conscious decision making? You know, we've looked at, you know, animal cruelty issues, health as well. Do you think there's another layer of this in terms of trends for next year?
If I could think of one, I'd let you know. Not me on that one, I'm afraid.
So in a sense, I mean, are people wary of forecasting trends for next year because there's been so much change? Because a lot of things that we've been talking about are pretty much extensions and you know, creep from what we've seen for the last year. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I don't think we've been not being innovative. Has everything just stopped for 9 months and now we're just going to see the creep continuing?
I think, to be honest, I suppose that's all about food trends and forecasting. It's very difficult to dissociate yourself from what's been happening in the last 6 months, a year, 2 years. Mm. And that the natural impulse is to see trends that you've been seeing develop a little bit further. What actually happens in reality, of course, is that some things do continue to accelerate and others calm down a little bit. I think one of the interesting factors is, you know, how many sort of health trends that we've copied in the UK or even in just the London market that have come from the west coast of the USA, but haven't necessarily taken off in a big way in the rest of the UK, haven't also translated across other European markets. And it's,
I think... Any specifics?
Well, I think, to give an example, we had a popcorn craze here a little while ago, and that tailed off fairly rapidly. And the assumption I and some of my colleagues made was some of the leading popcorn brands in the UK would have great success potentially in the European market, but in some European markets it just didn't gel. Mm. And another one around a similar time frame, maybe slightly earlier, was coconut water. You couldn't move coconut water exhibitors at every single food trade show. Mm. And when I first started discussing coconut water brands with some of my colleagues in European markets, you know, they were just, well, what are you talking about? We haven't got that here at all. And it didn't really move into those markets in the same way. When it did, it took a year or two to get there. So it's very difficult to make assumptions. And, you know, more often than not, we're going to be proved wrong in many of the things that we say. But we'll have to wait and see, won't we?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Mark, and you know, new product development has been disrupted by COVID this year, and a bunch of projects have been halted. But things seem to be coming back on track. Do you think that category development is going to be shifted by this sort of hiccup in NPD?
I think it's more of a glitch than anything else. I think you're going to continue to see, you know, an acceleration of growth in different NPD pipelines and categories, particularly around some of those, you know, emerging and novel foodstuffs. And some of the product development teams I've been speaking to have said, yes, you know, there's perhaps a glitch of about 3 or 4 months, but actually, you know, a lot of the kind of laboratories and research centres, you know, have opened up. So it's really only going to be a glitch than anything fundamental, as far as I can see.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So we've come to the final round now. I've got £10 million for each of you. And I'd like you to invest it in a sector for 2021. You can't invest in your own company. What would you put that money into? Laura?
Okay, so I know we've talked a lot in this conversation about sustainability, kind of looking at how sustainability and health can kind of meet each other and kind of communicating to consumers, kind of how these two intersect. But I also think that products that communicate their soil health credentials and regenerative agriculture is going to be really exciting, and how, like, through packaging and through kind of marketing campaigns, how they can kind of communicate that to consumers and make them care about it. So I'm really excited to see what's going to happen in this space, and that is certainly where I would put my money.
Is there a particular company you have in mind?
So there's a company that's, so it's a very small company in the Netherlands called Farm Brothers. Mm-hmm. And they make biscuits, a whole range of biscuits and vegan biscuits that use ingredients that are regeneratively grown. And on their packaging, they have a little kind of brown square that kind of illuminates how much soil has been regenerated per pack. And I really like that as kind of a really simple and easy way to kind of communicate.
It's a really good idea, isn't it? I've been wondering whether there will be, as well as sort of traffic lights for health and nutrition issues, whether there will be a sort of sustainability graphic as well, that you'll start getting on things, you know, CO2 embedded in the product and things like that.
Yes, it's like Corn and Unilever have both started putting the CO2 emissions on their packaging, and I think it's really good news for the industry, I think.
I think you're absolutely right. Okay, well, if you send me your bank details, I'll get that £10 million sorted for you. Simon, 10 million quid, where would you invest it?
Well, I'd probably split it in two if I'm allowed. 5 million would go into food delivery boxes, which is a trend we haven't actually covered so far on the podcast, which I think is about to hit the sort of breakthrough. I think that's a big trend for the future. And I think the other would go into cultured meat production, which again, I think in 15, 20 years time, that the profile of meat we may be consuming could come from quite different sources. And that's definitely something worth investing in.
I think that's absolutely right. Yeah, there's going to be a fundamental change there, isn't there? Mark, 10 million smackers, where are you going to put them?
I wish I'd actually put it into a company like Oatly 5 or 10 years ago. But I can't be retrospective with my investment.
No.
So I think it would definitely have to be in plant-based foods, particularly focusing on clean, labelled plant-based foods. Like Laura, you know, those that really regenerate livelihood soil. So I think half of my money would go into these leguminous crops, both for food and for feed. I suppose the second tranche of my money would perhaps go into some of these fermented foods, which again, perhaps we haven't mentioned necessarily. I see huge potential growth in the likes of algae, which offer, you know, excellent source of protein and open up a lot of opportunities to replace, you know, meat, so as meat analogues, for example.
That is a very, very good area that we haven't discussed at all yet, but it's possibly a good one for another podcast. Okay, well, thank you very much, everyone. I hope to see the investment flooding back in terms of returns. And thank you all for your time. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters, and you heard from Mark Driscoll, Laura Swain, Simon Waring, and me, Stefan Gates. Thank you all very much. Now, if you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from salmon farm sustainability to apprenticeships. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Goodbye. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.